Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Histories of the Unexpected, the show where we demonstrate that everything, simply everything, has its own history, like spiders, skateboards, and burgers.
And we will be following the links in our minds as we come across them, explaining how those histories link together in unexpected ways. Who knew, for example, who knew that the history of teeth, yes, teeth, is in fact all about identity in the Viking Age. It's all about Vikings sawing their teeth to make little grooves. Or that the history of bones, yes, skeletons and things like that, all very creepy, is in fact all about the English Reformation.
The man sitting opposite me who will help pilot us through this wonderful historical world is one of the country's leading professors of history. It's Professor Extraordinaire of Early Modern British History at Plymouth University. It's James Daybell. Hi, James.
Hello, Sam. And the man sitting opposite me is the famous historical adventurer, Dr. Sam Willis. Hello, Sam. Are you well?
I'm very well, thank you. I'm looking forward to doing this one. This is another episode in our special series of homeschooling for kids. In each episode, we take a subject that I bet you don't think has a history. And we're going to prove that it does. And today, you won't believe this, we are doing something James suggested last week. And I said, you can't possibly do that. He said, yes, 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 you can. We're doing the history of slobbering.
It sounds odd, but this is inspired by something that my 10-year-old daughter was doing for her history lessons. And I'd just like to say thank you to the wonderful, the terrific Mr. Pidwell for all his inspiration about this. So this, Mr. Pidwell, this is specially for you. This is all about, well, you'll have to wait and find out. But first, we will do a brainstorm on slobbering. So how do you talk? How do you write a history of slobbering? Which is basically the excess production of saliva. So it's spittle coming out of your mouth. If you've ever seen the film Beethoven, that enormous St. Bernard dog, and the slobber coming out of its mouth, and when it shakes its head, the slobber goes absolutely everywhere. You know exactly what we're talking about. So there we are. It is the excess production of saliva. It's about uncouth table manners. It's about people who don't really know the proper way to eat. They gorge, they feast. It's about grotesqueness. And then it's about the development of refinement and manners and eating nicely and not slobbering.
And wiping your chin, yes, when you're eating. So it's very much linked with the history of food. It's linked with the history of manners. To a certain extent, it's linked with the history of illness as well, and disease.
It is.
Mental illness as well. I was looking at the different symptoms of mental illness and how that is described at times throughout history. Smiling was often one. You know, the smile was something that was associated with the mentally unwell, as is dribbling and spitting.
And foaming at the mouth, which of course connects us to rabies, which historically was known as hydrophobia, in other words, the fear of water. And one of the symptoms later on, when it sets in, is the inability to swallow properly, and then the overproduction of saliva, so that people are basically almost frothing at the mouth in this way. Or it's connected to drooling of teething babies. So babies whose teeth are coming through. And in the 16th and 17th century, when physicians or doctors didn't understand quite how the body worked, they saw teething as a disease. And they saw they would anoint the gums of young children with with the brains of a hare or a rabbit.
Wow.
This would assist teething. I can't imagine any parenting guide today worth its salt that would get away with a little bit. If your child is teething, all you need to do is dash out the brains of a rabbit, rub it into an ointment, and then just pop it on the gums instead of Bongella. Can you imagine that? The history of slobbering or drooling is about appreciating things. So it's drooling over, say, a particularly choice piece of cake. Or it's about the history of adolescence, teenage boys drooling over girls. but really, the whole history of slobbering for us is a way of thinking about the history of James VI and I, the first of the Stuart monarchs who sat on the English throne. He's titled James VI and I because he was monarch of Scotland, where he was the sixth King James. At the same time, he was the King of England, James I of England in 1603, which saw the union of those two crowns. Now, Sam, you're going to tell us how we get to James VI and I from slobbering.
But we're all doing the history of slobbering because it's linked with James I, and there's a fantastic description of him by someone called Anthony Weldon, who is a 17th century courtier and a politician. And this is what he had to say about his king. He was of a middle stature, more corpulent through his clothes than in his body, yet fat enough, his clothes ever being made large and easy, the doublets quilted for stiletto proof. He was naturally of a timorous disposition, his eyes large, ever rolling after any stranger that came in his presence. His beard was very thin, his tongue too large for his mouth, which made him drink very uncomely, as if eating his drink, which came out of the cup at each side of his mouth. His skin was as soft as taffeta sarsent, like thin silk, which felt so because he never washed his hands, only rubbed his finger ends slightly with the wet end of a napkin. His legs were very weak, having had, as was thought, some foul play in his youth. That weakness made him ever leaning on other men's shoulders. His walk was ever circular, his fingers ever in that walk, fiddling about with his codpiece. He was very liberal of what he had not in his own grip, and would rather part with £100 he never had in his keeping, at 1 20-shilling piece within his own custody. A very wise man was wont to say that he believed him the wisest fool in Christendom, meaning him wise in small things, but a fool in weighty affairs. Well, that is some serious description of a king. This is from someone called Sir Anthony Weldon, as I said, and he hated the Scots, and that's why he wrote this abusive pamphlet. And the thing that really catches my eyes there was this description of why we're doing it with slobbering, was that he had this very thin beard, his tongue too large for his mouth, which made him drink very uncomely, as if eating his drink. Such powerful words, James.
They are, definitely. And one of the reasons that we chose to do this is because historians writing modern histories of James the Sixth and First still go back to Anthony Weldon's writing. And what we need to understand is that Weldon had produced an abusive pamphlet about the Scots, which he published in 1617. And before that, he'd been knighted by James. But James, being a Scot himself, was offended by this, and he dismissed Weldon from his court position. And Weldon then gets his revenge by writing this really acidic attack on James. And what's interesting is that this attack was not actually published until after Weldon's death. It was in fact published 1 year after the removal of the Stuart monarchy in England with the execution of King Charles I in 1649. And what's significant about it is the way in which it colours future generations of historians. And you can see it in a book called 1066 and all that, which is a sort of humorous take on the history of England. And in that book, where they describe, in very humorous way, James I, they have him as James I slobbered at the mouth and had favourites. He was thus a bad king. So we don't really need to take Anthony Weldon at face value. And I could give you a completely different view from the times of James as king. Now listen to this. This is an extract from De Fontenay, who was the envoy to James's mother, Mary, Queen of Scots. And it was written in 1584 when James was 18 years. To tell you frankly what I've heard about him, he is for his age the premier prince who has ever lived. He has three qualities of the soul in perfection. He apprehends and understands everything. He judges reasonably. He carries much in his memory and for a long time. In his questions, he is lively and perceptive and sound in his answers. In any matter which is being debated, be it religion or any other thing, he believes and maintains what seems to him to be true and just. He is learned in many tongues, sciences and affairs of state, more so, I dare say, than any others in his realm. In brief, he has a marvellous mind filled with virtuous grandeur and a good opinion of himself. So in other words, we have a very different and positive viewpoint here. And the important point for you to take away here is how you reconcile opposing views in the past that people have said about historical figures, and also the importance of the way in which future generations use those views as a way of looking at the character of this monarch. Now, what I'd like to do is to go beyond this and to tell you four important things that you need to know when thinking about James the Sixth and First.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
You need to see him as an experienced and intellectual king. So this is somebody who ruled for a long time in Scotland before he became King of England. So in 1603, he's been on the throne for quite a long time, since 1567, when he's a young child. And he's had an extraordinary education. He's been brought up superbly educated, Greek, Latin, history, composition, rhetoric, theology. So he's very, very schooled, very, very learned. He also learns his trade of kingcraft throughout the 1580s and 1590s and has very difficult problems with the Kirk or the Scottish Church, and particularly dealing with the extreme Presbyterian wing of the church. He's also sought during this period to re-establish the prestige of monarchy and to combat Parliament. And the other important thing to know about him is that he is a scholar king. He's somebody who is interested in ideas. He engages in the European debate about the true nature of kinship. And he publishes two books about this: The True Law of Free Monarchies in 1598 and Basilican Doron in 1599, where he makes a contribution to the argument for the divine right of kingship. He also writes a book about witchcraft in 1597, which is his belief in witchcraft, with undertones of scepticism about individual women who are accused of witchcraft. So he is an intellectual. When he comes to the throne in 1603, he's a very experienced king. He's not this drooling simpleton with uncouth manners. He's a learned, scholarly, and very experienced man. But once he's in England, there are several things that I think that are important to know about him. One is in terms of finances. He was extravagant, where Elizabeth I had been very careful with money, very frugal. He handed out titles, offices, and pensions with a trowel. This made him popular in the short term, but it actually, in the long term, increased the financial problems of the crown. And he gets into trouble with Parliament about this, and it leads to various disputes. The other thing that's important to know about him is his relationship with royal favourites. And there are two people in particular here. Robert Carr, who he promotes to be Viscount Rochester and the Earl of Somerset, and he falls in a plot or a sort of a scandal very soon. And also George Villiers, who is somebody who comes almost from nothing, and the king becomes infatuated with him. He makes him an earl in 1617, a marquis in 1618, and the Duke of Buckingham in 1623. And he becomes a very, very unpopular figure within the Jacobean period. Now, the final thing that I'm going to leave you with is this idea of his belief in the divine right of kings. In other words, that he was God-born for the role. And because God had chosen before he was born, that he would be king, he was not subject to the will of the people or the aristocracy or Parliament. And what's interesting about James is that he is one of the first people, one of the first monarchs to contribute to this theory of divine monarchy. And I just want to read you out an extract from James I on monarchy that was published in 1610 when he was aged 44. "The state of monarchy is the supremest thing upon earth, for kings are not only God's lieutenants upon earth and sit upon God's throne, but even by God himself they are called gods. There be three principal comparisons that illustrate the state of monarchy. One, taken out of the word of God, and the two other out of the grounds of policy and philosophy. In the scriptures, so in other words in the Bible, kings are called gods, and so their power after a certain relation compared to the divine power. Kings are also compared to fathers of the families, for a king is truly the politic father of his people. And lastly, kings are compared to the head of this microcosm of the body of man. I conclude then this point touching the power of kings with this axiom of divinity, that as to dispute what God may do is blasphemy. So it is sedition in subjects to dispute what a king may do in the height of his power. But just kings will ever be willing to declare what they will do if they will not incur the curse of God. I will not be content that my power be disputed upon, but I shall ever be willing to make the reason appear of all my doings and rule my actions according to my laws. In other words, what he's saying here is that it was God who set him up as the supreme power, as the monarch, and that it is blasphemous, so it is blasphemous to God if you challenge the king's power like this. And I think, Sam, that you're going to say a little bit about how this goes down in Parliament and how it impacts upon James's relationship with the House of Commons during this period.
That's right. And the James's relationship with Parliament is one of the most interesting things about his career. And it's so important, not only for how James lived and ruled, but also for what happens to his son, Charles the First, because what follows this all is the English Civil War. So James believes that his power comes from God and it is a superior power to that of Parliament, whereas Parliament believes that it's more of a contract, essentially, the relationship between Parliament and their king. And they certainly think that their views should be taken into account. There's a key moment when they do get on with each other and they do cooperate and work things out. And that is in the aftermath of the gunpowder plot in November 1605. But that was not normal for the relationship between James and Parliament. And actually, it was more characterised by mutual incomprehension rather than actual loathing, I think. There's a key moment in July 1604 when James gets very cross with Parliament for not agreeing to his demands, and he prorogues Parliament. He brings to an end a parliamentary session and he says, "I will not thank where I feel no thanks due. I am not of such a stock as to praise fools. You see how many things you did not well. I wish you would make use of your liberty with more modesty in time to come." So those are the words of a very angry man. And this very angry relationship does continue, but primarily for two reasons. First is because of inflation, and that's when the economy affects things. So a loaf of bread might cost 3 pence 1 year and then maybe 30 pence the next year. So prices are going up. And at the same time, James is spending lavishly on his court. And this means that the relationship with Parliament does continue to be very bad indeed. There are attempts to change it by the Earl of Salisbury. He's treasurer and he tries to get James to agree to something called the Great Contract, but it fails. And again, James is furious. "Your greatest error," he says, "has been that ye ever expected to draw honey out of gall." Gall, in that respect, being something very bitter. The similar pattern of conflict with Parliament continues with something known as the Addled Parliament of 1614. It was so called because it lasted only 9 weeks. It managed to achieve nothing at all. And when that ends, James rules without a Parliament at all for 9 years, more than 9 years, 9 years and 5 months until 1621. And then forces start overtaking him. There's a conflict on the continent. He wants to raise money to help his son-in-law with a war, and to do that he needs the help of Parliament. So he brings back Parliament. They do grant him some money, but at the same time they start trying to influence other aspects of his life. Particularly, they try and influence the decision of James as to who his son might marry, and Parliament wants his son Charles to marry a Protestant wife rather than the Spanish Roman Catholic wife that he has in mind. And again, it ends with James dissolving Parliament on the 6th of January 1622. So we've got this enduring conflict, usually over issues to do with money, but then moving on to much more significant issues about religion and about the future of the kingdom and whether his son is going to marry a Protestant or a Catholic. It's absolutely fascinating. And what's important is we all know that his son, Charles I, had such problems with Parliament. Cromwell ended up chopping off his head during the English Civil War. And so the historical question is, did Charles inherit those problems, the problems in the relationship between the king and his parliament, or should they be seen as completely separate? It's a good conundrum and one to think on, James.
Oh, that's a good question. I remember writing that as an undergraduate at university myself. Now, here is a take-home task for you. If you don't have the energy to write such an essay, what I suggest you do is create a timeline of the life and reign of James VI and I. This is something that historians always do when you're trying to get a sense of the main important events within a period. You have a list of dates and then you have a list of things that you're interested in. And this allows you to look at the development of events and history during a particular period. So you might, for example, start your timeline on the 19th of June 1566, when James was born at Edinburgh Castle. And then you might end on the 27th of March 1625, when James VI and I died and was succeeded by his son, Charles I. And all the things in between, including one of his great contributions to England, which was the authorised King James's version of the Bible, which was published in 1611 and was to become the standard text for more than 250 years. So there we are. There's James VI and I.
It's such a wonderful example of someone being tarred for history, and I think it's very unfair. I hope you've enjoyed listening to that. Do please check us out at historiesoftheunexpected.com and find us on social media. We're on Facebook, we're on Twitter, we're on Instagram. Come and make friends with us and do get in touch. And we'll be here along with some new stuff soon. Thanks, guys. Bye.
Bye.
Get all the Masterforce outdoor power equipment you need to maintain your yard at Menards. Own the outdoors with Masterforce 80-volt power equipment, delivering all the power of gas without the maintenance. The entire 80-volt line is powered by brushless motors for ultimate performance and productivity. From lawnmowers to leaf blowers, string trimmers, and more, find everything you need to create the lawn of your dreams with Masterforce power equipment at Menards. Save big.